I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Hey there, Macro Data Refiners. So glad to see you've decided to join me for this special edition of Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. Since the WGA strike continues and now the SAG-AFTRA strike is looming, it's easy to go a little stir crazy. Your Audi, well,
could be driving or skiing, whatever we do up there.
So they're fine. They're probably jet skiing or snowboarding. But down here on the Severed floor, the wait can be quite tedious. I've been looking for things to keep us all busy. There are only so many mental health walks Cobell is going to allow.
I thought Heli needed a walk. I mean, I'm allowed to do that.
This is another installment of Severed Origins, taking a deep dive look at those things cited as influences in the creation of severance. From the moment we first walked down a maze of hallways to sit behind ancient computers, I saw the very recognizable fingerprints of Terry Gilliam's 1985 dystopian masterpiece, Brazil, all over Severance. Dan Erickson has mentioned the influence of Brazil on his vision, but he really didn't have to. There's an indelible weirdness to Brazil. It is a singular vision and a singular movie experience. As usual, huge spoilers for Terry Gilliam's 1985 movie, Brazil. If you haven't seen the movie and you want to be surprised, you're going to need to stop the podcast in just a minute or two. But before you decide to go spoiler-free, I'd like to throw in an observation. You might enjoy your first watch of Brazil more if you've gone through it and heard a discussion about what was going on in advance. This is how I first experienced it, and it might be why I like it so much. It's a lot to take in. Having a couple of footholds to get your bearings helps. Knowing the story in advance is how I go to musicals. I like to find a good synopsis on Wikipedia and read through the story before I go to something like Hamilton or Wicked. I find following the story in a musical to sometimes be difficult. If I have a general sense about what's going on in my head, it's easier for me to hang the musical numbers on a through line. Same with Brazil. This is a complex movie, making big political statements overlaid with a huge helping of raucous farce. It's bizarre, utilizing a lot of unique and extremely weird imagery. Esteemed reviewer Pauline Kael said Brazil was, quote, like a stoned slapstick 1984, a nightmare comedy in which the comedy is just an aspect of the nightmarishness. And if you couldn't tell from that quote, she loved this movie. Everybody loved this movie, except Roger Ebert, and we're going to talk about that, too. So, Refiner, it's your call. If you want to hit pause and watch Brazil fully spoiler-free, go for it. Beyond here, there will be spoilers. If you want to go into this absurdist vision armed with some understanding about what the heck it is you're seeing, I invite you to continue. On you go. We're going to break Brazil down scene by scene, but before we do, let's take a moment to meet this guy whose name is all over the movie, Terry Gilliam. He not only directed it, he also co-wrote the original screenplay. You may have heard of Terry Gilliam as a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. It's true, Terry was a python, but he was often referred to as the unseen python. He was also the only non-British-born member of the troupe. Instead of performing, Gilliam was hired on to create the hilarious and trippy animation sequences which acted as connective transitions between skits in the 1969 through 74 BBC series. Using old photographs with animated cutouts of mouths or eyes, even disconnected legs or heads was a common theme in the Monty Python animations. Pointing hands might enter frame from anywhere. Photos of British and European architecture would often be dropped into animated landscapes. I used to love the giant foot, which would stomp on all action with a hilarious scrunching sound. Check the YouTube channel called Monty Python Cartoons for a look at some of Terry's best work from the Flying Circus. Terry Gilliam is originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He was born there in November of 1940. His family would move to Los Angeles when he was 12. He attended both high school and college in L.A. Seems like the perfect upbringing for a future film director, right? Well, not exactly. Terry attended Occidental College in L.A., where he got his B.A. in political science, which, you know, that's what you do to prepare for a career as a movie director. Right out of school, Gilliam worked for a national humor magazine called Help. He'd been a huge fan of Mad Magazine throughout his youth and was editor of a humor mag in college. Unfortunately, Help folded in 1966. That's when Gilliam immigrated to England. He claims he almost had to. The political climate of the U.S. in the 1960s, Vietnam War protests, civil rights marches, political assassinations. It was all too much for him to watch and stand quietly by. Gilliam later said he was worried he'd become a bomb-throwing terrorist if he'd stayed around the United States. He went to the U.K. instead, where he would become a British citizen in 1968. Almost immediately upon his arrival in England, he started making animations for BBC shows. It was through these TV production jobs where he met future members of the Flying Circus. As mentioned, Gilliam worked on the original Monty Python BBC series as an animator. He'd also make the occasional appearance as a supporting cast member. Although he's notched 33 performer credits on his IMDb profile, being in front of the camera really isn't his thing. One of those credits is actually an uncredited part here in Brazil. I'll point it out when we get there. Gilliam received both a written by and creator credit on 43 Monty Python episodes. But what he really wanted to do was direct. It was Terry who would take the Pythons to the silver screen. He, along with the other Terry, Terry Jones, would co-direct the 1974 hit movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Yeah, that guy you knew in college who talked only in Monty Python quotes, most of them were from Holy Grail. Trust me, they were. You've got Terry Gilliam to thank and or blame for that. His first solo directing gig came in 1977 when he both wrote and directed Jabberwocky. For the next 15 years or so, his writing and directing career would include solo projects like Time Bandits, Brazil, and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. He also wrote the screenplay for and directed Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, starring Johnny Depp. The screenplay was based on Hunter S. Thompson's groundbreaking Gonzo tome. Gilliam was more than qualified to bring the bizarre imagery to life on screen. Sandwiched between these personal, written, and directed by projects would be more Python work, but no more directing with the Pythons. After directing Jabberwocky, Gilliam said he realized the Pythons were not taking his direction seriously. He co-wrote Life of Brian and Meaning of Life. He also worked as director for animation and special sequences on Meaning of Life, but would not work again as a director on a Monty Python movie. He was included as a part of Python anniversary projects where he was usually credited as writer. Gilliam collaborated on the screenplay for Brazil, but the directorial vision was his own. The script was ultimately credited to Gilliam, Tom Stoppard, and longtime Gilliam collaborator Charles McCune. The original script was drafted under several different titles, including The Ministry, So That's Why the Bourgeoisie Sucks, The Ministry of Torture, and How I Learned to Live with the System So Far. That last one was a nod to 1964's Dr. Strangelove, starring Peter Sellers. Strangelove had a huge influence on the look and tone of Brazil. The official title of Dr. Strangelove included the subtitle, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Another working title that was given serious consideration was 1984 and a Half. It was intended as both a nod to George Orwell's 1984, the granddaddy of all dystopian sci-fi future predictions, and Federico Fellini's movie, 8 and a Half. Fellini had a huge influence on Gilliam's career. He even referred to Fellini as, quote, one of my gods. Ideally, Gilliam wanted to release his movie in 1984 with the 1984 and a half title as a way to invite comparisons to the original. Unfortunately, 1984 and a half had to be scrapped as a title because Michael Radford had done a movie version of 1984 in 1984, and he even called it 1984. As Gilliam said, that bastard. It has been noted by many reviewers, Brazil follows the rough outline of 1984, but as Roger Ebert said, the approach is very different. Gilliam also admitted right about this time, even though the movie is heavily influenced by the themes of 1984, he'd never actually read Orwell's book. Settling on Brazil for the name was just as weird as most everything else about this movie. It's not set in Brazil, and it's not in any way about the country or the people of Brazil. The name comes from the recurring theme song, Aquarela do Brasil. Released in 1939, it was performer Ary Barroso's most famous song. Translated, the title means Watercolor of Brazil. This popular song is known simply as Brazil to English-speaking audiences. Brazil is a light, poppy, upbeat number. Michael Kamen's arrangement and orchestration of the original becomes the leitmotif heard throughout the film. Oh, and of course, Kamen hates it. Gilliam has said use of the song was inspired by a scene he actually witnessed, a man sitting on a British beach with his radio. It was a cold and dreary day. The man sat defiantly alone on the sand, listening to the infectiously happy tune, Brazil. Gilliam said this man wasn't letting the reality of the day get him down, and the music seemed to provide a break from his grim and dreary situation. In Gilliam's mind, it was the perfect analogy for this movie. Most of the soundtrack is some variation of the tune. Gilliam's original cut of Brazil was 2 hours and 22 minutes, or 142 minutes total runtime. This version was originally shown to network executives in the summer of 1984. They considered it dazzling and impressive, but there were some big problems. For one, the execs thought of Brazil as being an art house type of release. Being tagged as art house was a death sentence for a major studio movie. Executives at Universal were also bothered by the ending. Universal was slated to handle the U.S. release. Gilliam's original ending is dark, keeping with the overall tone of the entire show. The 142-minute runtime was also too long for two showings a night. The original contract specified a movie with a runtime of less than 2 hours and 15 minutes for a very pragmatic reason. At 2:15, a movie theater could have two showings per screen per night. The runtime allowed for an early show at 7 and a late show at 9:30, leaving 15 minutes to turn the space. If you pushed that 9:30 start any later, execs knew no one would come to the late show. 20th Century Fox handled the European and international releases. They used the 142-minute version, and it was well-received. In the United States, distribution was being handled by Universal. Universal, and specifically Universal head Sid Sheinberg, had a lot of problems with the movie. It was too long to begin with, but Universal also hated that dark ending. They said it tested poorly. They wanted it changed for the U.S. release. Sheinberg forced a dramatic re-edit of the film, cutting it down significantly and giving it a happy ending. Universal even did test screenings, comparing the darker ending to the happier resolution. The happy ending was preferred by audiences. Well, at least according to Sheinberg. Although Gilliam tried to block its release, this very different version of the film did get out. You can still find the 94-minute Love Conquers All Sheinberg edit, even though Gilliam hates it. Because of the length, the 94-minute cut was used for syndicated television release, along with galleries and featurettes. It also appears on one of the Criterion boxed releases of the film. If you've ever caught a Sunday afternoon movie showing of Brazil on TV and your memory of it includes a fairy tale happy ending, what you saw was Sid's version, not Terry's. After a lengthy battle and at least one group of editors working on the film without Gilliam's knowledge, a final U.S. release was agreed upon. The accepted U.S. version was a 132-minute cut overseen by Gilliam. Even though the ending was still very dark, this cut overcame one of Universal's biggest hurdles. He got it down to 2 hours and 12 minutes so it would fit in theaters. The 142-minute, 132-minute, and 94-minute versions have all been made available on home media over the years. In the last 40 years, you could have purchased Brazil on VHS, Laserdisc, DVD, and Blu-ray. Check the runtime on the version you're watching to know which one it is. Gilliam refers to the 142-minute version as the, quote, fifth and final cut. We're going to review the 132-minute version because it's what was released in the U.S., but we're also going to talk about what's different between this one and the 142-minute international version as we go through the movie. There are a few scene differences, but the ending is the same dark Gilliam vision. As for the Love Conquers All version, it's really different and bears no resemblance to what Gilliam intended. We won't talk about all the changes Sid made because they are so numerous, but we will discuss how he radically changed the ending. Critical acclaim for Brazil has been off the charts, even though it was originally a box office bomb in the U.S. It's appeared on a number of best-ever lists, including a spot on the unordered Time magazine list of the 100 best films of all time. In 2006, Britain's Channel 4 voted it one of the 50 movies you must see before you die. On Rotten Tomatoes, the professional critic's tomato meter for Brazil redlines at 98%. Out of 52 professional reviewers, 51 of them certified Brazil as fresh. The lone holdout was none other than well-known Chicago Sun-Times reviewer Roger Ebert. He only gave Brazil 2 out of 4 stars, claiming it was hard to follow. According to Ebert, the special effects and sensational sets indicated too much budget and a general lack of discipline on the part of the filmmaker. It should be noted Ebert reviewed the 132-minute U.S. cut. Since he dinged it for generally being too much, I doubt seeing the extra 10 minutes in the international cut would have made a difference in his opinion. A number of filmmakers have mentioned Brazil as an influence over the years. Tim Burton studied the lighting and production style for his 1989 take on Batman. Interestingly, the Coen brothers have mentioned Brazil as influencing the visual style of their 1994 film, The Hudsucker Proxy. There's a great tie back to Severance here. John Turturro starred in The Hudsucker Proxy. I have always been a fan of Brazil, and it might be because of how I was introduced to it. I was a junior in college over the winter of 85-86. In January of 1986, for spring semester, I took a film criticism and appreciation class. The professor had been bowled over by this new movie he'd seen over the Christmas break. It was his habit to spend a lot of time in movie theaters during break checking out new releases. He could not stop talking about one film he'd seen in particular. Yep. It was Brazil. He even created a study guide for it. We talked about the symbolism and compared it to 1984, even though none of us had seen this new film. Then on like a Tuesday night in January, the prof hosted a voluntary field trip. Those of us who wanted were to meet at one of the local theaters that was still showing Brazil. We had to buy our own tickets, but we did get extra credit for showing up. If most of the class hadn't shown up, I don't think there'd have been anyone else in the theater. I had a pretty good idea of what I was about to see, and I knew what was meant by certain scenes. Understanding at least some of the imagery made my first viewing much more enjoyable. I knew the story, and I was watching for the hand of the filmmaker. Gilliam has said people walked out during early screenings. It was just too weird for them, and I can understand. It's very weird. I do think if they had been given some preparation, some prior understanding, those walkouts might have given it more of a chance. Since that class, I've always loved Brazil and have seen it a number of times. I've watched all 3 versions, and at one point in my life, I owned a boxed VHS release. I also own the Criterion DVD box set, but I do not have Brazil on Blu-ray. The stories involved with both producing and releasing this movie are as epic as the movie itself. Entire books have been written about the drama surrounding Brazil. I could go on for a long time telling making-of stories, but I'd rather get to the movie. I'll weave a few of those stories in as we go. Without further ado, Refiners, it's time to check out Terry Gilliam's Brazil, one of the inspirations for Severance.
Brazil, where hearts were gonna change in June. We stood beneath an amber moon and softly murmured someday soon.
The basic story of Brazil is a fairy tale mixed with a farce. Here's the elevator pitch. Sam Lowry is a government drone in a horribly overinflated bureaucracy. To escape his humdrum job, he imagines himself as a winged god, always rescuing a gorgeous blonde damsel in distress. After a typo caused by a literal bug, an innocent man dies of a heart attack during an interrogation. Since he was innocent and never should have been interrogated in the first place, he was overcharged for information retrieval services. Sam is forced to hand-deliver the rebate check to the widow. During this visit, Sam realizes the actual girl of his dreams lives above the wrongly accused man. She has shorter hair, but it's definitely her. Sam accepts a promotion so he can discover the identity of his dream girl. Sam is mistakenly thought to be providing aid and comfort to a heating and cooling terrorist. He is taken for interrogation and goes mad. In his insanity, he imagines himself escaping to the countryside with the girl of his dreams in her tractor trailer rig. In the final scene, we realize the trip to the countryside only happened in Sam's head. He is left catatonic, completely broken, and destroyed by the questioning. So, as you can hear, Gilliam could only do that pitch in very tall buildings. And that rundown doesn't even cover the overbearing mother who's addicted to plastic surgery, or the ongoing terrorist bombings, or Robert De Niro as the aforementioned heating terrorist, or Bob Hoskins as a government heating and cooling worker, or Terry Gilliam's obsession with ducts, ductwork, and whatever gross and disgusting things travel through ductwork. Oh, and if all that isn't enough to fry your any brain, this is also a Christmas movie. We open in clouds, flying through the clouds. The strains of the theme song with lyrics can be heard.
Brazil.
Get used to this song. You're going to hear it a lot. We're told it's 8:49 p.m. and we are somewhere in the 20th century. Wow, 12 seconds in and we've already got a lot of stuff to talk about. First off, did I mention this is a comedy? It is, and a pretty funny one if you can get past the Nazi references, bleak future predictions, and scenes of grisly, bloody torture. There are a ton of jokes. This isn't one of the better ones, but it is a joke. Gilliam has said Brazil is set in the current time. From his frame of reference, current time is 1984. The story was cribbed from the book 1984, and it was shot in 1984, so the time is an alternate universe of a London-like metro area in 1984. I would say, as well as it has held up over the years, and as crazy as life continues to be in our modern world, current time is appropriate now and probably will be 100 years from now. Gilliam really and truly sees this movie as being set in 1984. We will even see a receipt dated 1984 later in the movie. So it's set in the now, but why are there all of these weird contraptions in use throughout the government and the movie? The ancient computer workstations the Macrodatch use are nothing compared to this bizarre future tech. We're going to see some crazy stuff in just a few minutes. The computer keyboards are old manual typewriters. Ticker tape, actual paper ticker tape, is somehow feeding through what look to be either printers or readers. The computer monitors are tiny little black and white screens with a big magnifying glass over them. The men are all wearing suits that look like they're out of the 40s, and here's a big time giveaway, they're also wearing fedoras. For answers about the bizarre tech and retro wardrobe, we turn back to Mr. Gilliam. He said he felt like every futuristic sci-fi movie ever made has taken these big swings when it comes to predicting future tech. The reality, as we saw in several examples of Paycheck, is the filmmaker inadvertently creates a future world that becomes a twisted mirror of the time when the story is being made. So instead of coming up with wildly inventive future tech that would accidentally reflect the real 1984, Gilliam took a very Terry Gilliam approach to creating the world of Brazil. He decided to pretend he was a filmmaker in the 1940s. What would his future look like if he were trying to make a film in 1944 about the world of 1984? What you're seeing throughout the movie is this futuristic vision of a 1940s director as pictured in the mind of Terry Gilliam. Oh, and those clouds? Word is they were cribbed from the open of The Neverending Story. With permission, of course, but it makes sense. Why create new clouds when perfectly good Neverending Story clouds were laying around? It's one example of how Gilliam went way over on shoot days but was still able to bring this thing in under budget. There is some confusion surrounding these clouds. I reviewed both the 142-minute and 132-minute cuts of the movie, and both opened with the cloud fly-through and the CG overlay about time and place. According to the alternate versions entry on IMDb, these clouds were not in the original European edit. According to the trivia entry, the original European cut of the movie opened on the next scene, a close-up on a very 50s-looking television screen. A cheesy-looking graphic with animated ductwork fills the screen for Central Services. They've also got a super catchy jingle. In reality, not much pleasure seems to come from CS. The most British-looking man imaginable appears on screen with an array of ductwork behind him. This is actor John Flanagan.
Hi there. I want to talk to you about ducts. Do your ducts seem old-fashioned? Out of date? Central Services' new duct designs are now available in hundreds of different colors to suit your individual taste.
Ducks and the business of ductwork form almost their own plotline throughout the movie. Ducks are the way the populace is connected to the government, and it's not a pretty or fair relationship. The camera slowly pulls back. The ancient-looking TV screen is one of many all sitting together in another frame, a department store window display. The duct pitch continues on every screen as a male Christmas shopper wearing a fedora, pushing a cart filled with parcels, passes by the window from right to left.
Hurry now, while stocks last, to your nearest Central Services showroom. Designer colors to suit your demanding taste.
As soon as the shopper is centered in the frame, the window explodes violently towards the camera. The screen is filled with a fireball. The music changes to dramatic and foreboding. As the fireball fades to black, we can see red and bluish-purple lights. It's the title of the movie in neon. At first, we're seeing it on its side. The entire word flips upright, so we can see a jauntily rendered Brazil in neon. Over black, the word flies towards the screen and off. The transition from black reveals a stack of burning TVs. Now an interview with the head of the Ministry of Information is playing on the still-burning screen. We're introduced to Eugene Helpman, being played by Peter Vaughn. Helpman is going to become a big help to our hero, hence the name. There are several names like this one scattered throughout the movie. Eugene's is the most obvious. He's a helpful man. The man with two N's at the end is designed to look and sound vaguely German. There are a number of German-sounding character names in the movie and a lot of imagery evoking SS and Third Reich officers. Terry Gilliam moved to the UK in 1966. The sinister effects of Nazi Germany during World War II could still be felt strongly in Great Britain even 20 years later. Positioning men with German-sounding names as the bad guys in a very authoritarian government was quite natural for the transplanted Brit, Gilliam. With the Central Services spot over, we're back to the news program where Helpman is being interviewed. Check it out. The interviewer is also being played by John Flanagan. It's the same guy who just did the Central Services duct pitch, only now he's wearing glasses. John is a British actor with more than 70 credits on his IMDb profile. The topic of the interview, as usual, is about the terrorist bombings plaguing the city. Helpman is asked what's causing the increase in bombings lately.
Bad sportsmanship. A ruthless minority of people seems to have forgotten certain good old-fashioned virtue. I just can't stand seeing the other fellow win.
Okay, so Helpman might be a bit out of touch when it comes to the pulse of the nation.
If these people had just play the game, they'd get a lot more out of life.
As the television continues to burn, there is a cut to the same interview, only now on a different screen. This one is still very tiny and black and white, but this screen appears to be mounted on the end of a duct. We are now in the printing department for the Ministry of Information. A very precise-looking technician in glasses who's watching Helpman's interview. He reaches out to adjust the absurdly tiny black-and-white screen. Helpman seems to be practiced at this message. He defends the huge size of the Ministry of Information. It's a full 7% of gross national product. On the desk in front of the technician, we see a line of evenly spaced paper clips. This guy is very precise. The slightest thing could easily upset his world. Suddenly, his attention is drawn to a large bug flying by. The printing tech is being played by Ray Cooper. Ray is primarily a music producer and performer. One of his notable career peaks was touring with Elton John as a percussionist on John's Russian tour. Ray's been credited as a musician or composer on every Gilliam film going back to Time Bandits. Cooper has 11 credits as an actor, but most of those are small parts in Gilliam projects. He was credited in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas as a distinguished man. He was a functionary in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and he was the hands of the supreme being in Time Bandits. Cooper has a fun and pivotal part here as a printing tech in the Ministry of Information. The televised interview with the boss continues as we get a tracking shot along the ministry's printers. The shots in these printing scenes, especially when he's going after the bug, illustrates a Terry Gilliam signature to watch for throughout the movie. He loves to use wide-angle, close-up lenses. These are the same kinds of lenses we see Jessica Lee Gagne using down on the severed floor. They create an almost overwhelming frame full of information. The viewer is thrust uncomfortably close to the action when it's shot through a wide-angle lens. Gilliam achieved these wide-angle shots with three different lenses, the 14mm from Zeiss and an 11mm and 9.8mm from Canoptic lenses. The Canoptics were brand new at the time. Their claim to fame, they were the first lenses of that short a focal length that did not fisheye. Brazil was the first time Gilliam used the 14mm lens extensively. He later said the Canoptics were interesting, but performers did still bend at the edges of the frame when using them. He fell in love with the 14mm Zeiss during the making of Brazil. It became a signature in his later movies. He is so well known for this wide-angle shooting signature within the industry, the 14mm lens has become informally known as the Gilliam. The printers we see in the tracking shot are a sampling of that future tech we talked about as envisioned by a 1940s filmmaker. They have fabric ribbons and typewriter keyboards. Paper is feeding through platens, but we can also see ticker tape unspooling next to each machine. Seriously, ticker tape? Also, neither a 1944 nor a 1984 filmmaker could have envisioned society's move away from paper. There's been a move on for more than 20 years now to eliminate paper in the workplace. It's expensive, it's hard to keep and maintain, it's difficult to share printed materials with large groups of coworkers, and paper is an environmental disaster. Paperless workplaces have become a goal for many large corporations. After Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, one of the things the new regime requested was that coders print out all of their code and submit it for review. Print out? Twitter was almost a paperless office at the time of the purchase. There were stories of engineers frantically searching for the few remaining printers left in the San Francisco offices so they could actually print their code. Helpman has his satisfied smile on his face. He's very proud of his certain Ministry of Information innovation. Here's the thing. Questioning people is expensive.
That's why we always insist on the principle of information retrieval charges.
Torture, interrogation, incarceration. It's all time-consuming and expensive. The costs of the entire process are passed on to the suspect being interrogated. It's a big win for the ministry, according to Helpman. They seem to be interrogating a lot of people. The flying bug has become priority number one for the printing tech. He grabs a sheaf of papers and rolls it up like a weapon. As he jumps out of his chair, check the poster on the back wall. It's a drawn face with big red female lips. Across the top, it says, "Loose talk is noose talk." Wow, they are serious about not letting anything slip around this place. The drawn lips have a painful-looking padlock going through them. Across the bottom is the line, "Better sealed than sorry." This is seriously amping up the World War II message, "Loose lips sink ships." All of the posters we will see throughout the movie are either based on or inspired by historical propaganda posters, most coming from World War II. It's all part of that 1940s perspective. The new poster phrases used in the movie were written by Gilliam collaborator Charles McCune. I hope Ray got stunt pay for this next move. He stacks the filing cabinet from his office on his desk, then stands on the filing cabinet. It gives him just enough height to reach the bug, which is lighted on the ceiling. He gets off a good swat, momentarily sticking the bug to the ceiling. There is a rather gooey close-up just as it falls into one of the printers. There's a close-up on the forms being fed through the printers. These are orders for detention and interview being issued by the all-powerful Ministry of Information. This next bit is a little confusing. There's a close-up of the forms being printed. The last name we see on a couple of the forms is Tuttle. The falling bug causes a printer to spark. The next close-up shows one of the names adorned with bug guts. The name next to the goo now reads Buttle with a B. It's not incredibly obvious, but the bug caused a typo. It also updated all of the information about the new guy on this detention form. The guy the ministry was interested in is a heating engineer and terrorist named Archibald Tuttle. Due to the dead bug gumming up the works, the information order has been changed. It's now a request to detain Archibald Buttle. Buttle is listed as a shoe repair operative. He's a cobbler. This is a job you rarely saw in 1984. It's even rarer now. In 1944, it was a much more common profession. Gilliam credits co-writer Tom Stoppard with the bug idea for causing the print error. The printing tech returns to his desk, smoothing out the sheaf of papers he used to kill the bug. The Helpman interview continues on the small screen.
The bombing campaign is now in its 13th year. Beginner's luck.
Helpman has a hearty laugh, then turns to the screen sincerely. We get a transition to yet another version of a tiny black and white TV screen showing us this program.
Thank you, David. And a very Merry Christmas to you all.
The common tie from store window to print department to this new scene is the screen. This is how it was way back when we were all tied to live commercial programming in 1984. Sure, there were a few VCRs around allowing for some time shifting. It became a big joke later, but at the time it was true. Only a select few knew how to actually program VCRs. We also did not have the huge array of choices when it came to programming. There were the big three networks, a few indie stations, and PBS. It was an era of appointment television and water cooler conversations about popular shows. For many programs, we were all glued to the set at the exact same time. Oh, and yes, it is most likely Christmas Eve, although not much is different tomorrow if tomorrow is, in fact, Christmas. Helpman signs off. The 13-year bombing campaign raises some questions, like, who's actually doing the bombing? And with all this focus on questioning terrorists, why can't the government seem to get a handle on it? There's a high probability the government has created the idea of terrorists in the minds of the populace. They set off a bomb every now and then in a public place to keep the fear alive. A public bombing gives the Ministry of Information ammunition to haul in more, quote-unquote, terrorists for questioning. As the program fades to black and credits, the camera pans into this new location. We're going to find out in just a moment. We are in the apartment of Archibald Buttle and his family. That's Archie's wife reading the final lines of A Christmas Carol to their daughter. A young son is playing with a black toy machine gun and an action figure. The 9-year-old boy Buttle is being played by Simon Nash. His 6-year-old sister is being played by Prudence Oliver. Mrs. Buttle is being played by Sheila Reid. Sheila's a Scottish-born actress with 122 total credits on her IMDb profile. 3 of those are upcoming. Her career, comprised of mostly UK projects, extends back to 1960. A wide shot of the family reveals Archibald busily wrapping a Christmas present on the coffee table. Young boy Buttle, playing with stormtrooper action figures dressed all in black, seems to be a foreshadowing of what's about to happen. Ugly, unruly ductwork snakes through the ceiling of the Buttle's apartment. It takes away from the festive Christmas decorations. An aside, in case you get confused between Buttle and Tuttle as we go along, use this memory trick. Buttle is the butt of the joke. He's the guy who hasn't done anything, but due to a computer bug, he's going to be hauled away for questioning. Oh, and spoilers, the questioning is going to kill him. Noise can be heard from upstairs. The camera tilts up and we get a cut to another small black and white screen. This one is playing a segment of the Marx Brothers' first feature film, Coconuts, from 1929. We are in the apartment directly above the Buttles. Female laughter can be heard down the hall. The camera starts a trek towards the source of the sound. Something subtle is happening here that's not immediately obvious when you first see it. The TV is on in the living room. A series of mirrors have been set up to reflect the image back to the bathroom. A woman sitting in the bathtub is watching the reflected image on a small mirror. The TV volume has been turned way up so she can hear it in the bathroom. It's also probably why she didn't hear the ministry troops enter her apartment. The woman in the tub is Connecticut-born actress Kim Graist. She's playing the character of Jill Layton. This was only Kim's second movie appearance. She'd had a part in the 1984 horror movie CHUD, or Chud. She will rack up a total of 28 appearances in her career, a mix of both TV and movie roles. Her last listed credit is from 2001, doing a guest turn on an episode of the American TV series Judging Amy. Gilliam looked at a lot of very recognizable names for this role, including Patricia's sister, Rosanna Arquette, Rebecca De Mornay, Jamie Lee Curtis, Michelle Pfeiffer, and even Madonna. Gilliam's personal favorite was Ellen Barkin because she was both tough and sexy. Check the series Animal Kingdom for proof. He was right. Oh, and while you're checking out Animal Kingdom, don't miss Deachin Lockman's performance. Also, tough and sexy. According to all accounts, Graist had a great audition. Gilliam says she was ultimately chosen over these more recognizable actresses because she was such an unknown at the time. He wanted this character to be a fresh face to audiences. Gilliam regretted the decision later. He was never happy with Grace's performance, and many of her scenes were cut down or eliminated from the final edit. Gilliam claims working with Grace drove home the idea that experience really does count for something. Not only was her performance lacking in Gilliam's eyes, she was also difficult to work with on set. You'll notice a cloth bandage on Jill Layton's right hand. Gilliam claims he gave it to her just so the character would have a little personality. Ouch, that's a bit cutting. The Sid Sheinberg Love Conquers All edit restored many of Grace's cut scenes as a way to put more focus on the love story. Jill's apartment is filthy and dark. The only light is provided by trouble lights hanging from the ceiling, and, if possible, she's got even more ductwork than down in the Buttles' apartment. As the camera tracks into the bathroom, Jill is having a good laugh at the movie. A cigarette is dangling from the corner of her mouth, giving her a tough look. A cut to over Jill's shoulder reveals gray and murky bathwater. Suddenly, jingle bells can be heard, and a dark figure passes by, momentarily visible in the mirror. Jill's immediately on the defensive, taking the cigarette out of her mouth.
Who's there?
She slowly sinks into the bathwater, accidentally extinguishing the cigarette. In the 132-minute version, we cut from Jill sinking into the bathwater directly to an up-angle shot of the Buttles' ceiling. In the 142-minute edit, we get a couple of extra little shots before looking at the ceiling. There's a long shot of the bathtub as Jill sinks into it. We then cut to Mrs. Buttle and her daughter. The daughter has a question.
Father, Christmas can't come if we haven't got a chimney.
You'll see.
Then we get the cut to the ceiling. A perfect circle is being cut out from above as we watch. Plaster dust is raining down. The circle of ceiling crashes to the floor of the Buttles' apartment. This next bit is a frenzy of activity. A pole, much like you'd find in a firehouse, follows the circle of ceiling down into the apartment. Two stormtroopers dressed in black jumpsuits, helmets, and riot gear come sliding down the pole. It's a highly choreographed entry. The front door is ripped off its hinges and the living room window is smashed in at the same time as the pole drops. The entry sequence is slightly longer with a couple more shots in the U.S. version. A total of 8 or 9 helmeted and heavily armed Ministry of Information troops are suddenly in the Buttles' apartment. They're grabbing Archibald as his wife is screaming. The daughter is tossed in her lap. It's obvious they've come for Archibald. A heavy and horrible-looking canvas straitjacket with a full head-covering hood is thrown over Archie's head. By the way, I didn't mention it, but Archibald Tuttle is being played by veteran UK actor Brian Miller. Brian has 78 total credits on his IMDb profile dating back to 1964, with his most recent coming in 2017. Miller says he was booked for 5 days on this shoot, but they got him done in 3. Poor Archibald doesn't have a chance to defend himself. The straps on the straitjacket are pulled tight. The capture is concluded when a metal collar is snapped around Buttle's neck. At this point, the stormtroopers raise their weapons and snap to attention. The ceiling light in the middle of the room comes on and everything gets quiet. A man in a suit, breath mask, and fedora steps through the front door. He's carrying a clipboard and looks very officious. The man pulls down the mask, clears his throat, and begins to read from one of the papers he's carrying.
I hereby inform you on deposit entrusted to me under Section 47, Paragraph 7 of Council Order Number 438476,
that Mr. Buttle, Archibald, residing at 412 North Tower, Shangri-La Towers, has been invited to assist the Ministry of Information with certain inquiries,
and that he is liable to certain financial obligations as specified in Council Order RB/CZ/907/X. Sign here, please.
The man then hands his sheaf of papers to the still cowering and whimpering Mrs. Buttle. The man doesn't answer. He's too busy doing his job.
Say again, please. Just that.
She signs because that's what you do in this society. She's trying to ask what it's all about, but she signs without question. The man produces another set of papers, which she also signs, pressing harder this time.
That is your receipt for your husband. Thank you. And this is my receipt for your receipt.
The man turns and starts out of the apartment. From the hole in the ceiling, we can hear Jill.
Mrs. Buttle? Are you okay?
The sound startles the armed stormtroopers, whose immediate response is to fire into the ceiling. Amazingly, Jill is not hit. Check the edges of the hole before the shooting starts. The huge mess of ducts in the ceiling have been neatly sliced through by the hole-cutting process. Jill steps back from the hole as two Department of Works engineers appear. These are the guys who cut the hole. They are now tasked with replacing the missing section of floor if they can avoid getting shot.
We're Department of Works! Department of Works up here! Be careful with those bloody things!
Thankfully, no one was hit during the burst of gunfire. Gilliam's stormtroopers seem to have the same notoriously bad aim as the Empire's hired guns from Star Wars. The stormtroopers retreat after they realize there's no threat from above. Buttle's trussed-up body is carried from the room by two of the stormtroopers. His young son grabs him around the leg as he's being dragged away. The boy is easily pulled off by one of the imposing soldiers and tossed into the room. We cut back to upstairs. Jill, hair still wet and wearing only a shirt, is giving the work guys a hard time.
Don't touch me. Why don't you just get the hell out of here?
One of the workers is rolling a wrapped patch into place. It's a big round disc, the diameter of the hole and the thickness of the floor. It looks like a wheel from a Flintstones car. This hole-cutting thing must happen pretty often. They've got a pre-packaged repair ready to go. The works guy says they'll be gone in a jiffy. She has nothing to worry about.
It's Tuttle downstairs who can worry, eh?
Hold on a minute. That's not right.
Tuttle? His name's Buttle. There must be some mistake.
Mistake? The ministry doesn't make mistakes. Wow, one tiny bug falls in a printer and we get all this. As the works guys are telling Jill how they don't make mistakes, they place the patch over the hole in the floor. It falls right through, landing in front of Mrs. Buttle below.
Bloody typical. I've gone back to metric without telling us.
Nah, these guys don't make mistakes. Jill bends over to look down through the hole. She asks again.
Mrs. Buttle, are you all right?
She's definitely not. The stunned Mrs. B is standing in the middle of her trashed apartment, still holding the receipt for her husband, unable to speak. As the camera pulls out to the long shot, she is overcome. Mrs. Buttle collapses forward, fainting to the floor. There's a cut to close-up showing the receipt now on the floor, but still in her outstretched hand. British actor Simon Jones played the officious and unflappable arrest official in the previous scene. Bill and Charlie, the guys from the Department of Works, were being played by Derek Deadman and Nigel Planer. Both are veteran British performers with ridiculously long credit lists on IMDb. A chipper version of Brazil can be heard as we transition to a close-up of the other copies of the receipt Mrs. B signed. The white copy is spindled at a record clerk's desk. The pink copy is stacked in a tray alongside. The receipt has replaced the screen as our connection from one scene to the next. The pink copy is picked up by a mailroom person with a cart. The scene widens out to reveal a strange workplace. It's very industrial with the vague feel of the 1940s or 50s, but it's not a factory. It looks more like an office. The mailroom boys have slicked back hair, round glasses, and sweater vests over dress shirts with ties. Executives in suits are seated at computer-like workstations with the same small black-and-white screens like what we've already seen. The keyboard is a manual typewriter, and these computers have bellows on the sides and ducts leading into each workstation. The camera starts to track backwards and fast. The level of activity being revealed is crazy. Papers are shuffling in and out, people pushing around coworkers, files and more files being picked up and dropped off. As we round the end cap, another glimpse of the Noose Talk Lips poster we saw behind the print tech is briefly visible. A cart pushes into the camera, leading to a cut transition and more bustling activity. We're now tracking forwards, heading up the next aisle just as fast. Although it's made to look like we've moved over a row, this shot actually goes back up the same row of workstations. Men in suits are cutting left and right to avoid the camera and get to their next assignment. The forward tracking shot ends on a short staircase leading to the office of M. Kurtzman. Kurtzman himself is standing at the top of the stairs, quietly overseeing the intense activity of his department. These two insane long-range dolly shots remind me of something I really need to mention. Terry Gilliam is a student of film. Throughout this movie, we will see various scenes inspired by classic movies. Gilliam likes to weave them in, sometimes in glancing ways, as a nod to the great cinema that influenced him. These two amazing dolly shots, one going backwards and cutting to one going forwards, are an homage to a similar sequence in Stanley Kubrick's 1957 World War I movie, Paths of Glory. Kubrick's dolly shots happened in frontline trenches, so different context. Kurtzman is being played by Sir Ian Holm. Holm is considered one of the world's greatest performers. He's the winner of the Laurence Olivier Award, a Tony Award, BAFTA Award, and he's an Academy Award nominee. He has 141 IMDb credits dating back to 1957. This name, Kurtzman, is another one of those names I mentioned. It is literally German for short man, as in short of stature and short of accomplishments. The character of Mr. Kurtzman is a frightened middle manager who's probably not qualified to do what he's doing, but he manages to fake it enough to keep his job. The other reason for the use of this name in the movie is a nod to Gilliam's former editor at the humor magazine Help. His first name was Harvey, so not exactly the same. We can see that Kurtzman in the movie has a first initial of M. This unique space we're in is not a set. The Department of Records scenes here and later scenes in the expediting department are all being shot in the old and deserted CWS flour mill at the Royal Victoria Dock. Also known as Millennium Mills, this enormous structure looms over East London. It was built in 1905. The docks closed in 1981, and the mill has been sitting empty. It seems to be perpetually on the verge of being restored and turned into luxury apartments, but as of 2017, developers still can't seem to get anything going. While sitting empty, the mill has been used for other productions besides Brazil. It was a regular filming location for the British TV series Ashes to Ashes. It has also been featured in episodes of London's Burning and Luther, plus music videos from bands like The Smiths, Arctic Monkeys, Snow Patrol, and Coldplay. Most of the very grim-looking passageways and stairwells we see throughout the movie are being shot somewhere in the mill. Kurtzman yanks on a watch chain and checks the time. He then tucks the watch into his coat pocket. He seems precise and in control. His department is running like a well-oiled machine. Kurtzman turns and steps into his office. The instant Kurtzman's door closes, the activity stops. Each worker sitting at a console switches the screen over to what looks like an American Western movie. The rest, who had been frantically shuffling files just moments ago, are pushing up next to them so they can see. I couldn't find the name of the movie they're watching, but I did find an interesting bit about the music. You Pythonites may have caught it. The music playing under the gunfire is a piece called Flying Messenger by Oliver and Armstrong. It's the same piece of music used during Sir Lancelot's attack on the Swamp Castle during Holy Grail, which, you know, Terry Gilliam both co-wrote and co-directed. The piece was one of several licensed through the DeWolf Music Library, a British company that created the idea of library music for movies and TV. Yes, this cut was cheap library music because Holy Grail was made on a shoestring budget. The piece never had a single release, and the only place it appears on an album is the Holy Grail soundtrack. The scene cuts into Kurtzman's office. He's looking at another form generated to document the capture of Buttle. There are a couple of interesting details visible here. These guys who never make mistakes are showing Buttle with only one child. Also, if you look at the signature line, the signature is marked N.A., but the date has been filled in. It's 31-06-84. This is the European notation for June 31st of 1984. It's a subtle nod to Gilliam's original title, 1984 and a half. The end of June would be the exact halfway point of the year. But another error on the part of the ministry, June does not have 31 days in it. June is a 30-day month. Somebody from continuity should have stepped in here as well. How is it both the end of June and Christmas? Something's not adding up. Kurtzman enters Buttle's name into his terminal and gets an error message.
Oh, shit.
He punches a button on his intercom.
Mr. Lowry, would you step in here, please?
When there's no answer, he punches a button on his computer console. The movie the gang is watching out on the floor pops up on Kurtzman's monitor. If you're an Alien fan, you might recognize the noises being made by the computers. Gilliam used the same computer beeps as the ones emitted by Mother, the mainframe that controlled the Nostromo in the first Alien movie. We cut to an over-the-shoulder shot where we're watching the Western with the floor workers. They're enamored by what's on the screen. Cut back to a furious Kurtzman who whips off his glasses and jumps to the door of his office. He opens the door only a second or two later, but the movie is now off and the frenzied activity has returned. This gag definitely has a Pythonesque feel to it. Kurtzman scans the seething mass of workers looking for Lowry. He returns to the office and closes his door. The Western music begins again immediately. He throws the door open only to reveal more work activity. These guys are really good. Kurtzman decides to address the group.
I said, hey, has anybody seen Lowry? Has anybody seen Sam Lowry?
There is no response as his final syllable decays to an echo. We cut to gold-tinged clouds. This is a bit disorienting. The camera slowly pans right as a winged warrior flapping large wings comes into view, flying into frame from the left. He's easily soaring over the clouds. Listen to the soaring and heroic music under these shots. It's another version of Brazil. Cutting to close-up, we see the face of actor Jonathan Pryce. He has a swath of warrior paint over one eye and possibly glitter on his skin. His hair is blown out and curly. This is our hero, Sam Lowry, as he sees himself in his dreams. Pryce is a British actor, born in Wales in 1947. His career started in 1972 on British television. Pryce currently has 133 performer credits on his IMDb profile and 4 projects upcoming. Brazil is often cited as one of the best things he's ever done. His performance here is varied. It's comedic and outstanding. He's put in physically compromising situations throughout the movie, which he handles with the greatest of ease. He spent a lot of time in a flying harness for these fantasy scenes due to Gilliam's legendary dedication to perfection. Gilliam wanted the flying scenes to be perfect, and really, they do look pretty amazing. This was a full decade before computer-generated imagery and computer cleanup of things like guide wires. To get these images meant the role of Sam was pretty physically demanding. Legend has it, Tom Cruise was considered for Lowry when Lowry was supposed to be a younger character. No word as to why, but after reviewing the script, Mr. I Love to Do All My Own Stunts Cruise chose not to even read for the part. A woman with long blonde hair and what we now know to be Jill Layton's face looks to be trapped in a box floating in space. Gauzy fabric is swirling around her as she calls to her hero. Still flying, Sam gently kisses her through the fabric, then sails on by. As he careens into the clouds, we hear a horrible buzzing sound. There's a cut to a weird-looking device that might be a phone. It has a receiver across the top of it. The face, where you'd expect to see a dial, is a plug board like what a phone operator would have used in the 1940s or 50s. A hand reaches into the frame and plugs a jack into the face of the phone. As the shot widens out, we can see several wires connected to the sides and bottom of the unit. The hand grabs the receiver and the awful buzzing stops. Kurtzman can be heard on the other end of the phone asking Lowry where he is. Lowry at first believes Kurtzman has called him late at night. The clock reads 11:05. He then taps the top of the old dial-faced alarm with the receiver. The hands rapidly spin around to 5 a.m. What should have been Lowry's alarm much earlier this morning finally goes off.
The electrics here are up the spout.
Posters of film stars like Marlena Dietrich are visible on Sam's walls. The now activated alarm sets off a series of Rube Goldberg-style contraptions. Interestingly, this was a common variation on a theme in movies from 1985. Back to the Future opened with a series of Doc Brown's mechanized contraptions all triggered by an alarm clock. None of them was working properly and seemed to have been neglected for quite some time. Pee-wee Herman had several contraptions to start the day in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. He woke up to a regular alarm clock, but when he pulled it, a record player started. Downstairs, his breakfast machine was truly a thing to behold, and you can find this scene on YouTube. The big difference between Pee-wee's and the other two is that his all seemed to work. Sam's wake-up sequence is impressive, even if it doesn't all go exactly as planned. The blinds open and let in the late morning light. The bedroom light turns on. A round stopper extends and drops into the tub drain. The hot and cold taps turn on, presumably preset to Sam's favorite temperature. The clothes rack shoots out of the closet, bearing today's outfit. The toaster pops open, ejecting some good-looking pieces of toast. The coffee pot has a spout, which is where things go off the rails. It heats up just fine. When the coffee's ready, it shoots out of the spout. It starts out in the cup, but only for a second. Then, for some reason, the spout turns and soaks the toast, which was minding its own business over in the cooling rack. The TV turns on and swings out at an angle from the wall. I'm not positive, but I think the program playing on the telly is Python John Cleese in one of his many Muppet Show appearances. I could not find the clip, but that's definitely a Muppet to the left. The tall guy in the red hat and red shirt on the right has a mustache. JC is tall, mustachioed, and the only Python to appear multiple times on The Muppet Show. He was even in the 1981 movie The Great Muppet Caper. I've read in several articles that Gilliam split with the Pythons after the Holy Grail. Many reports make it sound acrimonious. I don't think that's quite true. It sounds like he couldn't deal with the entire flying circus as a group. Individual Pythons seem to have a great relationship with director Gilliam. Michael Palin has a fairly beefy part in this movie. Cleese plays Robin Hood in 1981's Time Bandits, also directed by Gilliam. Sam presumably hits the bath. We next see him entering the living area of the apartment. He's dressed, except for his suit coat, which he's carrying in his teeth. He steps around to the kitchen, but is distracted by what's on the television. Without looking, he pours sugar into the 2 ounces or so of coffee that made it into Sam's cup. Sam drinks what amounts to a mouthful of moistened sugar, which he spits into the sink. There's what looks like a pan in a microwave. Sam punches buttons and seems to make adjustments to the microwave, but he never opens it. He flips 3 switches on a panel to off. What seem to be warning lights on the panel are labeled normal, boost, and high. The coffee is a total loss, but he's still got the toast. He grabs a slice out of the cooling rack. As he's trying to take a bite of the coffee-soaked toast, it flops back and forth. He's unable to get it in his mouth, decides it's not worth it, and tosses the toast into the trash bin. So much for the modern conveniences of the future. Cut to a severe-looking gold statue. It's a winged male with a helmet for a head. Is this possibly inspiration for Sam's dreams? The statue is poised over a nude female figure. The inscription at the bottom of the severe-looking sculpture reads, "The truth shall make you free." This is a biblical quote from the Gospel of John, chapter 8, verse 32. It's been translated both as "make you" and "set you free." Armed guards are visible at various spots throughout the room beyond. At the base of the statue is a troop of Boy Scouts in uniform. Cut to a large sign that says, "Information, the key to prosperity." This message brought to you, of course, by the Ministry of Information. This poster is based on a 1923 Soviet propaganda poster. Resinotrest was created by Vladimir Mayakovsky. In the original, the word resinotrest is in the same font as prosperity. From a layout standpoint, what we're really seeing are red and green letters with a very wide white border. P-R-O-S and P are green letters with a thick white border. E-R-I-T and Y are red letters with the same heavy white border. Red and green boxes are used to divide the space, also like the original. Here, information is in a green box with "the key" reversed out of red. The long bars to either side of the word "to" also mirror the original. A group of nuns is gathered around a table displaying weaponry. A man in an extremely Third Reich-looking uniform is conducting a demonstration.
What's this gun for?
He picks up a hollow stock air-cooled submachine gun.
This one, sister, is a 9mm submachine gun used for close-quarter combat fighting.
It's a vicious-looking piece of weaponry. The nuns are suitably impressed. In the foreground is a full stormtrooper uniform with breathing hoses. In the background under this sign, it looks like Darth Vader might be lurking. A dozen black and white video screens display security camera views. It looks just like the Severed Floor security office, doesn't it, Refiners? Sam enters under a large poster of a man dressed just like Sam. The message under the man says, "Help the Ministry of Information help you." A sign to the right of the frame says, "Be safe, be suspicious." The camera follows Sam as he winds his way through the nuns and up the stairs to the Ministry of Information Department of Records. This is the group overseen by Kurtzman, who we visited earlier. The chromed helmets of the heavily armed guards match the tinsel in the sad-looking Christmas trees scattered around the lobby of the ministry. As Sam climbs, look to the right of frame on the top step. A security robot is coming over to do some scanning. We cut to a magnifier. Sam places his ID behind it. A gate opens. As soon as Sam steps through, the robot comes into frame. It's just a whirring, buzzing nuisance with a big eye. It doesn't seem to be performing any important function. As Sam is standing in a scanner, we hear a chipper voice.
Sam! Jack!
Well, long time no see. Hey!
A well-dressed man coming through security the other direction is smiling and waving. This is Jack Lint, being played by Sir Michael Palin. Palin is, of course, a member of Monty Python, as well as a noted British performer, world traveler, and all-around good guy. Palin has an alphabet after his name. His monarch-bestowed designations are as follows. KCMG and CBE, awarded for chivalry and public service outside of civil service. These are his knighthoods. FRGS and FRSGS, signifying a fellow of geographic societies from both Britain and Scotland, plus FRSL. This means he's a fellow awarded by the Royal Society of Literature. In addition to these lofty awards, Palin was also the lumberjack in the Lumberjack Song, and he not only co-wrote, but was the leader of the Spanish Inquisition.
Inquisition. Our chief weapon is surprise. Surprise and fear. Fear and surprise are two weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency are three weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope are four. No. Amongst our weapons. Amongst our weaponry are such elements as fear. I'll come in again.
Palin is hilarious, but also handsome. He's such a strong go-to performer, in one of the early drafts of the script, Jack Lint was the hero. The two men shake hands across the security barrier. Jack is noticeably more put together than Sam. He's wearing a nicer suit and tie and just seems generally more polished. These two have a history, but Sam is surprised to see Lint here in Records. Jack recently received a promotion to information retrieval. It's a more prestigious and important post. When Sam asks, what's the problem, Jack seems nervous.
Problem? No problem. Everything's fine. Wonderful. Marvelous.
The man seems to protest too much. He says his wife, Allison, and the kids are in great shape.
I'm on security level 5 now, so Mr. Helpman relies on me more and more.
Helpman, you remember, is the guy we saw on the TV screen last night during the store bombing and bug smashing. Sam's not buying the breathless and nervous declarations.
It's been a great year.
You sound worried.
Jack laughs it off. Worried? How could he be worried when things are going so well? He turns the question around, saying if he's worried about anything, it's Sam.
Sam, whatever happened to you? Records?
As Jack is talking, Sam sees an image of Jill Layton on one of the security monitors over his shoulder. Sam is distracted to the point Jack looks around to see what he's looking at. Sam then scans the lobby to see where this image is coming from. He can't locate her. Sam decides to end the conversation. He's late for work and needed by Kurtzman in records, after all.
Jack, it's great to see you. I'm going to be late.
He quickly turns. Jack chases him and lectures him.
Sam,
let a friend tell you. Your life is going wrong. Records is a dead-end department. No security level worth a damn. It's impossible to get noticed.
This is exactly what Sam wants. No pressure, no responsibilities, no recognition, sure, but recognition means you have to answer for things. Sam is well aware of his position.
I know. Wonderful. Marvelous. Perfect. See you, Jack.
He likes being an unimportant functionary, a cog in the machine. He has no desire to be an even bigger cog or, heaven forbid, one of the guys running the machine. Sam continues toward the elevator.
Give my regards to Allison and the twins.
We then get a cloning joke.
Triplets. Triplets. God. How time flies.
I didn't get it and probably would never have gotten it if I hadn't read about it. In this world, if you have a kid you like, why risk having one you don't like? Get the good one cloned. Jack already had twins because they'd cloned the first one. Now the twins have become triplets because they decided to go get another clone of the original. As Sam gets on the elevator, the camera pulls back to reveal the controller for the robot we saw earlier. It's a portable tiny black and white monitor with joystick, which allows an operator to move the robot and camera around the lobby. It looks like it might be a new ministry innovation. The robot is positioned alongside the line of folks waiting to talk to the porter. It so happens Jill Layton is next in line. She's there to report a wrongful arrest. Her downstairs neighbor, Archie Buttle, shoe repair specialist. Jill is doing the government department shuffle. She's got the right paperwork, but not the right stamp.
Is it stamped?
No, it's not.
I can't let you have the form until this is stamped.
Where do I get it stamped?
Information adjustments.
Where she'd just been. The porter is being played by British actor Gordon Kaye. He smugly dismisses her and hands back the sheaf of papers she's carrying. As Jill's leaving, she takes her frustration out on the robot. She pushes the head forcefully so the camera spins around. A quick cut back to the group using the remote shows static on the screen. Jill storms off and we cut to Kurtzman's office. Sam is at the console with Kurtzman peering over his shoulder. At the cut, the camera starts on a small sign above Kurtzman's desk. We didn't see it before. This one reads, "Suspicion breeds confidence."
Keeps picking up old films. That can't be right, can it? Perhaps the machine's on the blink.
No, it's not. Those are coming from his insubordinate staff, but he's too clueless to realize it. Sam catches the problem. There's a mismatch on the personnel code numbers for an information retrieval charge.
Buttle should have had £31.06 debited against his account, not Buttle.
Kurtzman is shocked.
What a mistake.
Sam says at least it's not theirs.
Isn't it? Whose is it?
Sam places the blame on information retrieval. The government can make mistakes, just so those mistakes can be traced to someone else's department. Sam starts to read off the departments involved in this foul-up.
Information retrieval.
Oh, good.
Yes, the expediting is put in for electrical procedures in respect of Buttle Archibald Shoe Repair Operative. Security has invoiced admin for Tuttle Archibald Heating Engineer.
Kurtzman is relieved. He doesn't care about the error, just that it's not his. He tells Sam to finish his tea. Sam also grabs a biscuit and puts his feet up on Kurtzman's desk. Did you catch the amount of the information retrieval charges? It's another nod to the date. £31.06 is that incorrect date. Again, June 31st. Sam may be the only competent member of the records department. Kurtzman says he doesn't know what he'd do if Sam were ever promoted. Sam, of course, says he has no interest in being promoted. He tells Kurtzman not to worry.
I've told you before, I turn it down.
Was he? Really?
Sam assures him, yes, he would turn down a promotion.
You've been promoted.
This is a shock. Sam quickly turns and spills his tea, reaching for the order Kurtzman dropped on the desk. A quick aside about Sam's background. As we'll discover, Sam's now deceased father was a very high-ranking official with the ministry. He was above helpman at one point. Because of his father's success, there have always been big expectations surrounding Sam. He's shunned advancement throughout his career. Sam has chosen to be where he is, ignoring the pressure being put on him to climb the ministry ladder. Sam's mother is another matter. She wants Sam to have the same power and insider status as his dad. She doesn't care what Sam wants.
It's your mother, isn't it? Pulling strings again.
As the wife of a former high-ranking ministry official, she does still have some strings to pull. Speaking of pulling things, we get a disorienting cut to a woman's face, and she seems to be in distress. Her cheeks are being pulled to impossible lengths, stretching her mouth wide. Although it's hard to tell from first glance, this is legendary American actress Katherine Helmond from Galveston, Texas. She's playing the character of Sam's mother, Ida Lowry. Helmond was a fixture on American television for nearly two decades. After 88 episodes of soap from the late 1970s until 1981 and 196 episodes of Who's the Boss from 1984 through 92, it's possible Catherine has spent as much time in your living room as you have. She seems to love the Gilliam craziness. As part of her 102 acting credits, Ms. Helmond also appeared in Time Bandits and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. For this role, she says Gilliam told her, "I've got a part for you, and I want you to come over and do it, but you're not going to look very nice in it." Catherine Helmond is as fearless as they come. She committed immediately. Unfortunately, Katherine Helmond passed away in February of 2019. The cheeks being pulled are, of course, a mask. Helmond was forced to wear this mask for up to 10 hours a day during production. The blisters it caused meant there was a delay in shooting her scenes without the mask until the blisters had healed. Oblivious to the man stretching her cheeks, Ida is berating Sam.
Sam, it's time for you to grow up and accept responsibility. Your poor father would be appalled at your lack of promotion.
The camera pulls out to reveal Dr. Jaffe as the one stretching Ms. Lowry's cheeks to the extreme. Jaffe is being played by legendary British character actor Jim Broadbent. Born in 1949, Broadbent has 168 credits on his IMDb profile, dating back to 1971. He's still very active, with three credits coming in 2022. So far in 2023, he has one project in the can and two others in production. Broadbent is one of two Oscar winners in this cast. The other is Robert De Niro, who we'll be meeting shortly. The cast also includes five Oscar nominees: Ian Holm, Terry Gilliam, Charles McKune, Bob Hoskins, and the lead, Jonathan Pryce. Ida's wearing a pink skull cap with some kind of metal band running over the top of her head. Gilliam wasn't kidding about Helmond not looking so good in this part. We cut to a wide shot of the room as Sam responds. This space is outrageous. This is not a set. It's actually the Arab Hall in Leighton House on Holland Park Road in London. This is a lavishly restored Victorian interior created as a display in the Leighton House Museum. Sam is wandering around the space arguing with his mother.
Mother, I just wish you would stop interfering. I don't want promotion. I'm happy where I am.
Ida knows better. She tells Sam he's not happy. She then brings up Jack Lint, Michael Palin's character, who Sam just saw earlier today.
He doesn't have your brains, but he's got the ambition.
She tells Sam even though he doesn't have ambition, he has her and the deputy minister. This would be Helpman, who we met on the small TV screen last night. Dr. Jaffe continues to pull and knead Ida's extremely stretched out cheeks. He's put huge metal clips at the ends of the pulled out skin to hold it in place. Ida is preaching to Sam when Jaffe tells her to not get upset.
Mr. Lowry, please wait in reception. You're giving her wrinkles.
Ida is addicted to plastic surgery. She's constantly chasing her smooth-skinned youth. Chaps like Jaffe are more than happy to cash in on the youthful desires of wealthy widows.
I'll make you 20 years younger.
He's like a snake oil salesman promising youth and beauty while painting cut lines on Ida's face.
Oh, Dr. Jaffe, you are a genius. Would you like to be Surgeon General?
Ida does enjoy throwing around her connections.
I know simply everybody.
After painting lines all over her face, Jaffe completes the process by wrapping her entire head with clear plastic wrap.
And already she's twice as beautiful as she was before.
voila.
He spins her in the chair to reveal a hilarious horror show. Ida's marked-up face is now squeezed and flattened into the plastic wrap. There's a slight change here between the two versions. In the 142-minute version, we cut to a security screen outside of a restaurant. We hear Ida continuing to berate Sam. They speak for a few seconds before entering the restaurant. She tells him Helpman and information retrieval will take Sam under his wing. In this longer cut, Ida places her bag on an X-ray scanner. Whatever she has inside sets it off. It turns out she's carrying an executive desktop toy as a gift for her son. She grabs the gift, hands it to Sam, and is thoroughly disgusted with the treatment she's receiving while entering the restaurant. In the American cut, when Ida is spun around in the plastic surgeon's chair, Sam has an additional line.
Voila!
My God, it works.
We then cut to the restaurant entrance, only this time without Ida's additional comments. They just skip the entire security scan sequence. Instead, we cut in past that scene already at the top of the stairs. Sam is walking along behind his mother, now looking in the present box, which he's already been handed. The net effect is to speed up this scene by about 30 seconds. Ida says the present is very exclusive. Well, it's really not. It's one of those desk gewgaws that became popular with executives after the Newton's Cradle Clacky Balls made it okay to have toys on your desk. This one is an executive decision maker. It's a metal weight on a string. If you turn a handle, the weight is lifted to the top of the device. Hitting a button releases the weight, which drops to land randomly on either a yes side or a no side of the base. It's a lot fancier than a finger trap. Later, Jill Layton will be carrying a whole box of these same toys to use as bribes with mid-level managers. The maitre d' somehow knows it's Mrs. Lowry without even looking up.
Ah, Madame Lowry, you look exquisite today.
Because Sam's suit is of such poor quality, the maitre d' assumes Sam is some kind of vagrant trying to crash the restaurant. He pushes him back like he's going to throw him out. Ida casually says,
"You remember my son, Samuel?"
As a reminder, only then is Sam allowed to pass. The tremendously snobbish waiter is being played perfectly by British actor Brian Pringle. Do not miss Ida's outfit. The humor is everywhere. Sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's a giant shoe on the head. This also has a Python feel to it. Ida is surely a fashion plate. She wears only the latest and most popular styles. She walks into this restaurant wearing a leopard print short coat with a matching leopard print hat. Only this hat is in the shape of an enormous shoe. It's upside down on her head with this huge high heel sticking up. She wears it like it's the trendiest of couture, but I can't stop snickering every time I look at it. Check this space. It's another amazing location. This restaurant is actually the grand entrance hall of Mentmore Towers in Buckinghamshire. Originally built for the Rothschild family in the 1850s, this space has been used in numerous films. It was the interior of Wayne Manor in Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins, and the Cairo Museum in 1999's The Mummy. This is the only version of Mentmore Towers where you'll see enormous ducks running all through the grand hall. A film class aside about the ducks. Now that we've been in several spaces with overbearing ductwork, you might be asking yourself, what's up with all the ducks? The ducks are open to interpretation, but the film professor I mentioned earlier had a theory I've always supported. The ducks are the physical manifestation of government control in our lives. As you're sitting in your home in the evening, think about how much government is still there. You pay taxes on the property you're living in. You might also be in a water district or a library district. There's probably a township that's taking some taxes and creating some rules. No matter where you are or what you're doing, in a modern society, the hand of government is always there, and usually they're kind of overbearing and gumming things up. Gilliam is giving us a visual representation of this constant and overbearing government involvement by connecting every citizen with ducks. They're everywhere. Usually they're ugly and overbearing, but always at least somewhat necessary, just like government. Mrs. Lowry is meeting her good friend and fellow aficionado of plastic surgery, Mrs. Alma Terrain. Alma is being played by Barbara Hicks. It's another one of those names, as in rough terrain. We will discover Alma has some issues. Finding the perfect plastic surgeon seems to be a favorite pastime of idle rich widows. Mrs. Terrain recently abandoned Dr. Jaffe. She thinks of him as the knife man because he cuts during his procedures. She has gone instead with Dr. Chapman. Ida refers to Chapman as the acid man because he prefers to inject flesh-eating acid into the skin of his patients to achieve their sculpting aims. Alma finds it much more civilized than all the cutting. We will meet Dr. Chapman later. The name is a reference to Python Graham Chapman, who did have a medical degree. Alma has started her procedure, but the large bandage on the left side of her face indicates things aren't going well. Ida sweeps into the room as though everyone is watching her, which they just might be. Alma has brought along her socially inept daughter, Shirley.
Oh, God. She's got what's her name with her.
Shirley seems to be wearing some kind of a mouth brace. Ida tells Alma she looks wonderful. Actually, she looks like she's been in a fight. This entire scene is a skewering of posh and trendy restaurants. The menus open to reveal backlit screens. Entrees are ordered only by number. Alma and her daughter take a 1 and a 2. Ida says she's trashing the diet with a number 8. Sam thinks ordering by number is embarrassing. He tries to order a steak, no number. The waiter won't allow it.
Monsieur Quel numéro?
I don't know which number. Mother, please.
That one. There.
That's fine, thanks. Mother, will you please listen to me?
Alma, you wicked girl. You started your treatment.
Say the number, please.
You noticed.
You have to say the number.
Please go away. I must talk to tell you all about it.
Number 3.
Seconds after the orders are placed, the waiter slams silver domed platters onto the table. Ida has gone with braised veal and wine sauce. Alma took the duck à l'orange and Shirley ordered crevettes à la mayonnaise. As each plate is revealed, what they are served looks like pastel-colored ice cream scoops of goo. A stand-up photo of real food is included with each plate, but the food itself is 3 scoops of colorful goo. Even Sam's steak is nothing but scooped goo. The food seems to be what the diners expected.
Mesdames, monsieur, bon appétit.
Merci.
The horribly awkward Shirley turns to Sam after the waiter has left.
So.
As soon as she says it, the entire restaurant is rocked by a bomb blast. In one of the DVD commentaries, Gilliam says this scene is inspired by experiences he had during the Troubles and the many IRA bombings that rocked areas of London while he lived there. In the 142-minute edit, we get a couple of lines from Alma about her procedure right before Shirley offers the salt.
Acid, on the other hand, can be used for such wonderfully subtle shading, such delicate nuances, like a Rembrandt etching. It is so much quicker. Why, if it wasn't for this complication, the doctor says it could have happened to anybody, I'd have had this dressing off yesterday.
The violent blast leaves diners bloodied and injured. Waiters are holding their heads. The chamber group on the raised stage was to the side of the blast. They were close enough to have soot all over their faces, but they realized the show must go on. The music continues while secondary explosions are still happening. Those who weren't in the path of the blast do their best to ignore it. Ida keeps talking over the noise.
I saw the most wonderful idea for Christmas presents at the chemist. Gift tokens. Medical gift tokens.
Alma, of course, thinks it's a wonderful idea.
Oh, that sounds marvelous.
It's good at any doctor's and most of the major hospitals.
Firemen arrive with tanks on their backs to put out the rather large fire. Injured are still being helped from the scene as the fire is put out. More stormtroopers and emergency personnel are rushing into the restaurant. All the activity is deafening. The diners continue trying to ignore it. Alma asks Sam if he can't do something about all of these bombings.
It's my lunch hour.
Besides, it's not my department.
Sam's mention of his job reminds Ida. She has a big announcement.
Look, Sam's been promoted to information retrieval. That's wonderful.
Alma congratulates him. Sam is furious. This is what he was hoping to discuss with his mother over lunch. He snatches a copy of the order from Alma's hand. Ida somehow had Sam's paperwork and she's passing it around.
Stop it!
The noise and confusion continues. Waiters rush to hide the blast area. A screen is pulled into place behind Ida. It does nothing to mute the sound, which is still deafening. Ida ignores Sam's anger. He gets up, ready to storm out. She tells him he can't leave. He hasn't had his dessert.
I don't want dessert. I don't want promotion. I don't want anything.
Of course you want something. You must have hopes, wishes, dreams.
No, nothing. Not even dreams.
Ah, but Sam's not being exactly truthful. He does have dreams, and we cut into one of them right here. This is the second of Sam's fantasy flying sequences. Sam doesn't have actual wings in these dreams. He's still a man, but he's wearing some kind of flying rig. It mounts to his back and shoulders. He's using his arms to make the large wings flap. It's a great looking effect. Sam's dream girl is calling for him again. He wheels in the sky, looking down at the fields below. Suddenly, the countryside breaks into rough squares. Each one explodes up out of the ground, creating towers of dirt looming in front of our hero. He can't reach his damsel in distress. Check the dirt tower effects. Again, this is being shot in 1984. No CGI, no computer animation. These shots are being done with miniatures and slow motion effects. So what do the towers mean? Well, like any good dream, it's open to interpretation. I've always thought the towers represent the bureaucracy, which is housed in tall buildings, popping up to intrude on his dreams. A bit of foreshadowing, if you look at it like that. The looming towers shooting up from the ground are in the way. They block Sam's access to his dream girl. As the towers keep blasting out of the dirt and blocking out the sky, we cut to real-life Sam, now thrashing around in his bed. He's having a nightmare, and he also looks to be uncomfortably warm. He's covered in sweat, looking distressed. A red light is pulsing somewhere in the apartment. Cut to a large dial thermostat on the wall. It looks like it's reading 106 degrees. Sam fights with it a moment, trying to turn it down. He then steps into the front room, where smoke is billowing. It looks like the smoke is pouring in through the wall vent. Sam is forced to exit his apartment. We cut to a long down-angle shot showing Sam's front door. It leads out onto a high balcony in a very futuristic-looking apartment building. This is not a set. It's another amazing shooting space. This is a very modern French apartment complex built about 20 miles east of Paris in 1984. The neighborhood is Noisy-le-Grand. The building is the Palazzo de Abraxas Apartments. It's a spectacular housing complex that was maybe too ambitious. It's run down and neglected in several places. It does look pretty amazing on camera. These structures also stood in as the capital of Panem in The Hunger Games: Mockingjay. There are tons of stories surrounding this place. Check the Wikipedia entry or do a Google search for Palace de Abraxas for details and pictures. At the point where Sam steps out of his front door, the American edit has picked up a minute and 20 seconds over the European edit. Cutting 10 full minutes had to hurt. Sam clears the smoke enough to get to his phone. He plugs in the right combination of cords.
Hello, Central Services. I'm at 579B, Block 19, Northwestern Section D. That's Exit 1 on Green Pastures Highway at the Orange Blossom Flyover. And I've got trouble with my air conditioning. It's an emergency.
Sam is dripping with sweat. This is certainly an emergency. The message he gets back is some of the funniest doublespeak in the movie. Central Services can no longer take service requests centrally after hours.
Have a nice day. This has not been a recording.
So is this a real person reading this message over and over after hours? Sam reiterates.
This is an emergency.
The message begins again.
Thank you for calling Central
Services. Sam says he needs a heating engineer. Each time he speaks, he causes the message to start over.
Oh, shit.
He slams the phone down in frustration. Another one of those things we could do in 1984, but no one has the chance to do today. When's the last time you were able to forcefully slam a receiver onto a phone cradle? The smoke continues to pour into Sam's apartment. I'd be worried about fire, but he believes it's all HVAC. Cut to Sam, now asleep, with his head resting on a shelf in his very 1940s-looking refrigerator. The fridge, by the way, is an R-3406-J. The phone bleats, causing Sam to jump. He whacks his head on the fridge roof. He finally gets the phone plugged up and is able to answer it.
Hello.
A figure in jack boots and dark clothes can be seen standing behind Sam. He's laying on the floor after his fight with the phone. The voice tells Sam to put the phone down and raise his hands.
What who is this?
Sam turns, suddenly face to face with a gun being trained on him by the dark figure. The figure is talking to Sam on a wireless phone. This tech is a bit futuristic for 1984, very futuristic for 1944. Sam, receiver still to his ear, puts up his hands. The figure tells him to keep his hands visible. He then goes to the walls, listening for the noises being made by the air conditioning.
What are you doing?
The figure seems satisfied with the situation and pulls down his face mask.
Harry Tuttle, heating engineer at your service.
This name rings a bell with Sam. It was a big part of his day at work.
Tuttle?
What a coincidence. The focus of his investigation is here. Sam wants to know if he's from Central Services. Tuttle, who's spreading out a work blanket, scoffs at this. Sam says he called Central Services.
Well, they're a little overworked these days. Luckily, I intercepted your call.
As the shot goes to close-up, check the hands going through the tool bag. These are actually Terry Gilliam's hands in a later cut-in shot. Oh, and yes, dear Refiner, if you haven't recognized the voice, surely you recognize the face of American icon and Academy Award winner Robert De Niro as Harry Tuttle. There are a number of stories surrounding De Niro's involvement in Brazil. Some of them are even contradictory. Based on what I could find, De Niro really wanted to be a part of this project. He originally was hoping for the character of Jack Lint, but Gilliam had already promised it to Michael Palin. De Niro is said to have been so excited about being in a Terry Gilliam movie, he agreed to take the lesser role of Tuttle. Even though his role is fairly minor, De Niro's name was used liberally in the promotion of the movie, especially in the U.S. In one account I found, they said De Niro wanted to be in the movie so badly, he worked for free. This didn't sound right. Even if De Niro himself wanted to work for free, he's supporting a whole layer of managers who wouldn't have allowed it. Another report said he was paid a total of $660,000 for 2 weeks' worth of work. That might be going too far the other way, but this is Hollywood. If De Niro did get $660,000, it means he made more than Jonathan Pryce got for nearly 9 months' worth of work. Stories about De Niro being a pain in the butt to Gilliam are more common. Terry was supposed to have been excited about getting such a marquee name in his movie, until he'd worked with him a couple of days. De Niro had millions of questions about the character, constantly pelting Gilliam for more detail. Where every other actor was fine with 2 or 3 takes of a scene, De Niro would demand 25 to 30 takes of each scene. Even then, he would still forget his lines. There's even a story that De Niro supplied all the stuff on Harry's work belt. He felt the character would have a tool belt, so he made one. Even though Gilliam sounds like he regretted hiring De Niro, De Niro has said he loved the experience and would work for Gilliam again anytime he called. Refiners, before Harry starts his work, we need to step back for a moment. This is a big file. You've met the major players, you've got a feel for the plot, now it's time to shut things down for today. We will resume the file called Brazil next time. Harry will repair the air and Sam will deliver a rebate check to Mrs. Buttle. That's when he'll discover his actual dream girl lives upstairs at the Shangri-La Towers. I'll also have more background and details about shooting and production of the movie. So make sure to join me next time for the second part of our origin story about Brazil. For now, we're done for the day. No news yet on the delivery of Severance Season 2. We still have strikes and production cycles to get through. Stay positive, Refiners. We'll get through this together. Be watching for Brazil Part 2 the next time we gather. If you could, exit via the elevator. And remember, please, stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.